was quite a brief introduction where I give you hopefully a kind of picture of what is loop quantum gravity, or what is the aim to, if we want to quantize general relativity, starting from an action and using, so what I said is that we're going to use Dirac program for to quantize the action of gravity. So I'm going again to focus on 3D gravity, Euclidean gravity, with a zero cosmological constant, okay, just for simplicity. And so today, so what is the first ingredient we need? As I said, we're going to start from an action, and the aim is going to apply on this action the Dirac program to quantize. Okay, but the Dirac program is a canonical quantization, so we first need to find which action we are going to consider, okay? And then we need to do the canonical analysis of this action. So this is going to take us, at least this week, I think we are going to talk only we are going to stay at the classical level, because there are many things to do. Because what I want to show you first is why the action of gravity is so special and why it's difficult to apply the Dirac program. So we can see that using also just example of different system and see what are the difficulty here, okay? So, for today, let's talk about just the action, okay? So first I'm going to review of the 4D Einstein-Hilbert action that you should know from your lecture of GR. And then I will go to the 3D case, and we're going to see what makes 3D so special and why it's easier to study 3D gravity than 4D gravity. And then the Einstein-Hilbert action is a metric is written in terms of metric variables. And we want to go to the first order formulation starting from these metric variables. And so we need to introduce the triads, and then we're going to see that we also need some other variables, which are the spin connection. And finally, hopefully at the end, we will have the 3D first order action for gravity, okay? So this is the idea for today. So why do we want to focus on the action? So the action is really the starting point for most quantization techniques, and we are going to focus on this one, but for any, even for then, at the end of the 3 weeks, hopefully we will have time to talk about spin foam, and as I said, the spin foam model are quantized using kind of path integral techniques. But again, we will start from the same action. At least in 3D, it's going to be the same action, and try to see how we can apply this technique. And from the action also, the action is going to encode the basic variables. So by basic variables, I mean the kinematical degrees of freedom, because we are going to see that with this action, we are going to have so variables and then constraint. And so the physical degrees of freedom are not going to be the one encoded directly in the action. And an important point that we're going to spend some time is that from the action, we can really see what we call global symmetries and the local symmetry. And the local symmetries are going to play a quite important role in quantum gravity, in gravity itself, because local symmetries mean that we're talking about gauge symmetries, okay? So I guess you already know some gauge theory. Some of you should have followed the lecture on the course on the standard model. So in the standard model, most of you are talking already about gauge theories, okay? Okay, so let's start now with first the review of the 4D Hilbert action. So it's going to be a quick review. Because then, so what is the idea? And we're going to see how it simplifies in the 3D case. And then from that, we're going to construct another action, okay? So first we do this review, then we are going to see how it simplifies this 3D case, and then from this action, we are going to build this first order action, okay? So the Einstein-Dilbert action is written in terms of metric variables. So what is the action? So let's put kappa for the coupling constant. And so we have the Ricci scalar, then the square root of the determinant of the metric. And here, if we are in 4D, this is the measure. Okay, with here, kappa is going to be but we're going to take it equal to 1. Okay, I'm going to forget about this constraint, this constant, sorry. And so here, what is the fundamental field? The fundamental field is the metric or even the inverse of the metric. Okay, so at the classical level, it's going to be the same thing to talk about the action in terms of the metric or the inverse of the metric, and then yeah, if you go to the quantum level, then you can have some subtleties, but we're not going to talk about that here. So now, what are the equations of motion from an action? You can deduce the equation of motion obtained by just varying the action with respect. So here, it's easier, in fact, to vary the action with respect to the inverse metric, but this is really, so we're going to the inverse. But this is really equivalent to do variation with respect to the metric, since we have, so equivalent to do variation with respect to the metric, since you have, using just this relation, the fact that the inverse rho, so you have a delta mu rho, and using that, you can always, you can compute that the variation of the metric can be expressed in terms of the variation of so let's check if I haven't done any mistake with the indices. Okay. So here you can just express the variation of the metric in terms of the variation of the inverse metric. So it's really, it's just a choice what is easiest for you if you want to express everything in terms of the metric or not. And of course here I'm using the Einstein convention. I guess you're all quite familiar with that. So meaning that if two indices are repeated, this means that I am summing on this index. Okay, so what is going to be the variation of this action? Let's say that delta S can be decomposed in three parts. And so with delta S1, so this one is more difficult to compute, and I'm not going to do it here because, so tomorrow you have a tutorial, and if you want to, and maybe you already did that, did you look at the variation of this action in the, yeah? Okay, so I can go really quickly, but so if you want to review that, there is a question on the tutorial tomorrow. And I don't know which, because there are several methods to compute this term. I don't know which one you already use in the lecture, but so in the tutorial, it's asked using normal Riemann coordinates, okay?
Is it the tutorial today?
No, it's, yes.
Today.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm supposed to come to your tutorial, so it's good that you remind me that it's this afternoon, yeah. Okay, yeah, it's, okay, so this afternoon, But it's still tutorial one, so I haven't wrote anything wrong here. Okay, thanks. So this afternoon, yeah, you can, if you want, you will have the opportunity to try to compute against this term. And if you remember, what you're going to find is that this term is a total derivative. So if you have the right boundary condition, then it's going to vanish. And in our case, we're going to consider the simplest case where we don't have any boundary, so we don't consider this term, okay? Just to remind you. So then the second one is just, so I'm just writing what is, are we, so here I just decompose, of course, the Ricci scalar. And so here you don't have anything to do. It's already, you already have directly the variation with respect. And the last one is also asking you some computation because you need to write what is the variation of the determinant of the metric. But again, so here you just use the standard formula for the determinant of a matrix, and then you have a quite complicated formula in terms of the metric, and you can compute explicitly what is this term. So at the end, so this one is okay. And so if you go to tutorial one, this one you will see that it's a total divergence, so we are not going to consider it. So it vanishes if right boundary condition, but it's what we're going to consider here. And here you need to, so you need the variation of the determinant. And G can be, so this determinant can be expressed in terms of the metric using just the general expression of the determinant of a matrix. And so if you want to see here, you can see Bianca Dietrich lecture notes. I'm going to post them for you because she's writing explicitly the calculation. And here what you get is so you get a minus because we are looking at the variation with respect to the inverse metric. Okay, so this is, now we can, so the delta S is just delta S2 plus delta S3. And so what do we get? We get what we are expecting here. R mu nu minus 1 half of R G mu nu with the variation on the inverse metric. And this is the Einstein tensor. So what we get here are, of course, the vacuum Einstein equation. So G mu nu is equal to zero, where G mu nu is R mu nu . And do you know how this can simplify? Do you see that when it's a vacuum equation?
Sorry.
So this equation, so you can write this Einstein tensor, but you can also simplify this equation. Do you see how it can simplify in the case where you're in the vacuum? Yeah. Okay, is that clear to you? You get that? And this is equivalent to say that so do you know how you get from here to here? Okay? So you take just the trace of G mu nu, and when the dimension is greater than 2, which is the case we are interested in, then you end up with just this equation. You can simplify it. Okay? Okay, so this is just starting from the Einstein-Hilbert action. You get the vacuum Einstein equation. And so now, how does it simplify in the 3D case? Okay? So let's go now to 3D gravity. So here, if you can see, we haven't used at all the dimension of the manifold in the previous derivation. So it's really valid, except to go from here to here, you have to have the dimension greater than 2. But so now let's take that the dimension is equal to 3. So again, so we have 3D gravity is defined with the same action, okay? So now we are in 3D, and we have the same equation of motion. Same action, same equation of motions. So we still have g mu nu, which is equal to 0, which is equivalent to say that the Ricci curvature is equal to 0. But so now the fundamental physical difference between gr in 2 plus 1 and 3 plus 1 originate in the fact that the curvature tensor in 2 plus 1 depends just linearly on the Ricci tensor. Okay? So what does it mean if your curvature tensor depends linearly on the Ricci tensor? What does r mu nu equals 0 imply? You see? Yeah?
Yeah, because you are dealing with flat space time.
Yeah, so if the curvature tensor is linear in that, if this is equal to 0, this means that then your curvature tensor is going to be equal to 0, so you are dealing with a flat. At least when you don't have any cosmological constant, otherwise you're going to deal with constant curvature, okay? So, and so this comes from equals, so what is the origin of that? Is that your curvature, your Riemann, so it depends on the yeah, sorry, I'm missing an N. Okay, but this can also be concluded by counting the number of independent components in the Riemann and the Ricci tensor. So let's just do that again to convince you. So what are the properties you know on this Riemann tensor? So you know that it's antisymmetric. In the first two indices. So what does it mean? How many antisymmetric pairs do you have among in 3D? You know how to compute antisymmetric, the number of antisymmetric pairs? What is the formula? So if you have n object, yeah?
N times n minus 1 over 2.
Yeah, okay. So this is the number of antisymmetric pairs. Thanks, Eugene. So if now you apply that when n is equal to 3, what do you get? You get 3. So here, this means that you could replace this pair of two indices by one index. Running from 1 to 3. And you have the same property in the last two indices. So again, you have one index running from 1 to 3. And what is the last property I'm going to use is that it's symmetric. Under exchange of the first index pair with the second. So how many symmetric pairs now do you have among three indices? So what is the formula now? So this is for the anti-symmetric. If you have symmetric, how do you compute that?
N times n plus 1 over 2?
Yeah.
But instead of n, we should set, instead of n, we set n times n minus 1 over 2.
So no, now n is 3, okay? Because you have each, we said that we have three. This can be replaced by one index running from 1 to 3, and the other one 2. So you have like two pair of three indices, okay? So here, if n is equal to 3, you get 6. So this means that we have 6 independent components. Do you agree? Yeah. And if we now we look at the Ricci tensor, what is the property of the Ricci tensor? How many independent components do you have?
Does the Planck identically vanish?
Yeah, it vanishes automatically in 3D. So we don't have, yeah, we don't have to check that, yeah. So do you know how many independent indices we have for the, in 3D, yeah?
6.
Yeah, why? Because here it's symmetric, okay? So it's 3 and 3, but symmetric again, so we have the same number, okay? So it's another way to see that indeed we really have the same number of independent components in the Riemann tensor in 3D and in the Ricci scalar, okay? So it's not really a proof saying that this implies this, but at least you can. And in fact, so here we are in using so the Einstein action with this equation of motion. But we will see that when we will be in the first order formulation, the fact that the curvature vanishes is going to be quite much more obvious, okay? So what is the conclusion here in 3D? In 3D, this means that every solution of vacuum Einstein with here lambda, so lambda, by lambda I mean the cosmological constant is equal to 0, then is going to be flat. And this is the conclusion. Every, and so it's what is going to make things much easier, of course. The vacuum Einstein equation with also, so lambda is a cosmological constant, okay, is flat. And if lambda is not equal to 0, then it's going to have constant curvature, okay? But we are not going to focus on this case. And so what does it mean? This means that physically, in 2 plus 1 gravity, you don't have any local degrees of freedom. So curvature is going to be, if you have some curvature, it's going to be concentrated at the location of matter. So in 3D, usually it's going to be defined by punctures, okay? And so also this means that there is no gravitational waves in 3D. And so if the the only, you will have only global degrees of freedom, which come from the topology of your manifold, okay? So if you look at the space-time, which is topologically trivial, then in fact you will have no gravitational degrees of freedom at all. And the global degrees of freedom depend just on your, or the topology of your manifold. And this can be characterized by the fundamental group. Are you familiar with that? Yeah.
You said yesterday that there will be one parameter that we cannot fix and will cause a problem in 4D. Does it have any relation to this, to the cosmological effect?
No. So I think you're referring to the Imirzi, what I call. I was
yeah,
gamma,
some,
this gamma,
yeah,
Imirzi Barbero parameter. So yeah, very good. But this is, no, it's just in the definition in the HTK variable in 4D, okay? So in 3D, you don't have this parameter. Apparently.
But what is the physical interpretation of gamma that we don't have in 3D?
It just, in 4D, so let me try to. So, because we are going to see that here in 3D, we are going to use directly the triad and everything. It's going to be already SU2 gauge theory, in fact. Whereas, in fact, in 4D, what is done, so it's historically, it hasn't been done like this, but it's that we have gauge fixing. So, you fix the gauge, that's what you also have still a SU2, and it's in the way the variable are constructed that. You have this this option to put in addition this parameter, but in 3D there is not really the room because the variable we're going to use are directly the one from the first order formulation. Whereas in fact in 4D, if you start with the, so it's going to be the Plevansky action. If you start from that, it's not going to be directly the tetrad and the connection that you are going to use. You first do. A gauge fixing, and then you define your variable. And in fact, this gamma can be seen as so the relation between the different HTK variable. It can be seen as a canonical transformation that we don't have here in 3D. Okay, so it's a bit technical. But maybe at the end of the lecture we'll come back on this parameter. Okay, so. So yeah, as I said, now it's only going to be characterized, the number of degrees of freedom is going to be characterized by the the topology of the manifold, okay, and it's going to be global degrees of freedom. So if M has a non-trivial, if your manifold has a non-trivial fundamental group, then you will have a finite number of degrees of freedom, which remain. So let's start with, so here, yeah, we don't have no local degree of freedom. We just have global, we'll have just global degrees of freedom, which are going to depend on the topology. So let's consider our manifold M, and as I said, we are going to be interested in the canonical quantization, so we are going to look at M as so this is just the real line times sigma, which is a 2D surface here, and this is okay, you can always do that as soon as you are talking about the globally hyperbolic spacetime, which are usually what we consider here. And in fact, the 2D case is the last case where we can really classify the topology, okay? So in this case, we can really classify all this topology. And if we look at the topology of an orientable 2D surface, then any surface is orthomorphic to either a sphere, a two-sphere, okay, or the connected sum of tori. So tori is plural for torus. Okay, so and this will depend on the genus of your surface. So the number of tori you will have is related to the genus. If you have a genus G for your 2D surface, then you will have G tori. Okay? And of course, the two-sphere has a trivial fundamental group, meaning, so what does it mean? The fundamental group, in fact, is just a kind of way to count the number of topological distinct closed curve, okay? So indeed, on a two-sphere, you can have only one curve. Each curve can be deformed with the same curve. But for the torus, so let's look at the torus now. Okay. Do you know how many parameters you need to describe your torus? So you can, in fact, get from a flat piece of paper like this, what is a torus? A torus is when you identify this side with this side and this side with this side. So you can try to build one. It's not going to be like, and then you're supposed to close, okay? So of course, my piece of paper is a bit short to do that, but this is the idea, okay? So this means that you can start from that, and then you're going to identify this side with this side, and then this, let's do like this side with this side. I don't know if it's very clear. So this obtained torus, so you have different kind of torus, is going to be flat. Not all tori are going to be flat. But you will have two parameters here. Okay, so if I look at this kind of bagel, this torus, then you need a parameter to describe the length of this curve around like this and this one, okay? So you have these two curves, so these two parameters are going to be the length of the curves. And now we are not going to do that, but if we are studying the equation of motion on this topological, on a torus, okay, on this topological sphere, then you could find that the equation of motion will tell you how the length of this curve are going to evolve, okay? Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about 3D gravity, but so just to conclude, so it's flat, so this means but what is really important is that we have no local degrees of freedom, so it's what is going to make things much easier, okay? But we are still going to see that we can learn a lot to try to quantize this action and in 3D.
So this magnitude R times sigma is the most general one you can find if no local degrees of freedom are present?
No, it's just from the manifold. We will assume that usually we can decompose our manifold this way. And this is not really a restriction because this is valid as soon as you are talking about a hyperbolic, as soon as you have a globally hyperbolic space-time, which is usually what we consider in GR, okay? So this is not really a restriction. This is, you can, in space-time we are going to consider, we can do that,
sure,
okay?
But it's not one.
Yeah, no, if you don't have a globally hyperbolic space-time, then in some cases you won't be able to do this. So. Okay. Okay? Yeah?
Did you say that this torus is flat, where you had, so you have a sheet of paper and you identify the side of the side, this side of the side, and that's flat? Did you say that? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. So you can have something which is periodic in two directions, but still flat.
Sorry, can you hear John?
I mean, it's periodic in both directions, but it's still flat. So yeah. It doesn't look like a torus, actually.
Yeah, so if you look at, if you really look at this piece of paper, then when you are going to consider this torus, then we said that we don't have boundary, but here you're right that if then we focus on this, it's like looking at something with boundary condition and with some periodic boundary condition. But so, no, it's just a way to build this one, and it just, because there are different ways to build a torus, and with this way, it's the one usually we consider in this case, okay? Okay, so now let's try to build the first order formulation of gravity. So for this, I'm going to introduce triads, new variables, okay? So as I said, in Einstein-Hilbert, the basic variables are the metric which encodes the geometry of the manifold. But now I'm going to introduce the tria. So let's... This is a third power, so let's call that small c. So first, of 3D gravity, and the first ingredient we need are what we call the triads. So have you already seen this first order formulation? Yes or no? Yeah, you, Christophe, I know that you. No one? OK. So we are going to start with what you know, OK? So the metric, and then build this action. So the first ingredient, so what we can introduce is, so we can introduce an orthonormal frame at each point of the manifold and here what I mean it's a field of, so it can be valid in any dimension, but here we're going to focus on n equal to 3 vectors mu I, where I go from 1 to n, so in our case it will be 3. And we have this orthogonality property here that this translate. Go. Implies that g mu nu mu I nu j is delta ij. So here I have this delta ij because I'm considering the Euclidean signature. Okay, so here it's because it's Euclidean. If I were looking at the Minkowski signature here, of course, I would get the Minkowski metric. Okay. So already at this level, we need to specify what is the signature of the space time. Okay, and of course, for I is the number of I is a dimension. So E mu I here is what we are going to call a triad. And so in 4D it will be a tetrad. And in n dimension, it's what we call n binds, okay, coming from German. So now we could also define the inverse triad, which is going to be just defined as g mu nu e mu delta ij. So these two are inverse of each other, okay? But, and this is what we call the co-triad. And it's a, so this, you can consider that as a vector. This is going to be a one form, okay? Okay, and so what is the relation between now g mu nu and this co-triad or triads, okay? We have g mu nu is equal and again here you have the delta because it's the Euclidean signature, okay? So what does it mean here? And so to convince yourself, you can see that, of course, you can start from here and you will get usually if you start from here, I think then at the end you get the inverse metric. But if you start from here, if you contract that by, you will get this equation by contracting. New k, okay? So if you want to recover.
Do we refer to two different types of indices that have different names? We have the new beta, and then we have some.
Yeah, so we're going to see that this is a kind of internal space, okay? In fact, it's on the tangent space. And yeah, it's going to be very important. And so now we are going to see that we have additional symmetries, okay? So it's what's going to make things quite different. And maybe you can already see from here, because how many parameters do you have here? Component do you have for Gmu nu in 3D?
Six,
yeah. And here, so here it's 3, and this is 3. So how many do you have?
6 for each one.
Yeah, so it's 3 times 3, so it's going to be 9. OK? So here we have 3 and 9. So we can already see that we introduce some irrelevant information here. And so do you have an idea of what is this additional symmetry or information we have? What is the freedom that we have here that is not going to change this metric? Yeah?
Rotations.
Yeah, OK, because so what is this triad? I said that it's a frame. It's an orthonormal. So this means now at each point of your manifold, you have this orthonormal frame. And of course, you can rotate it at each point, and it's a local symmetry, so that's why it's going to be a gauge symmetry. It's local because it's at each point of your manifold. You have at each one of your manifold, you have this orthonormal frame, and that you have the freedom to rotate it. Okay, and we're going to indeed, I'm going to show you explicitly that it's not going to change the metric. So I can see that Eugene is already working in quantum gravity. He already knows a lot. So this is, six component, okay? So the number of degrees of freedom. You have 6, and here you have 9. And so here it's a co-triad. So here what you can see is that the metric is really the pullback of the Minkowski of the flat, here it's more the flat metric, to the tangent space, or the tangent space given with these indices. Okay. So what is so this is your orthonormal. The triad is orthonormal mal frame, and so it can be rotated. So let's see now. Why indeed that indeed your metric is going to be invariant if you act with a rotation. So this means that we have an additional gauge symmetry. But in fact, yeah, because SO3, so it's a group of rotation, okay, we're aware of that. But in fact, we are more going to talk about SU2 gauge symmetry. Why? So first, because it's going to, we can do that because in fact we are only going to work with Lie algebra valued object. And so do you know, everyone knows that at the level of the algebra, SU2 is the same as the SO3 algebra. Okay, so we are going to work with object with value in the algebra. So we can talk about SU2 or SO3 the same thing. And this, why is it interesting to work with SU2 gauge symmetry? Is because then we can really use the tools of SU2 lattice gauge theory, which is theory which has been quite well developed, so there are many tools. So yeah, when Ashtekar, so yesterday I told you that one of the first steps to make things working with gravity was when Ashtekar introduced this new variable with the SU2 connection and densitized triad, and then this was really the hope that now, yeah, we have many tools that we can use coming from SU2 lattice gates. So, yeah.
Isn't SU2 a double cover of SO3?
Yeah, so at the level of the group, but yeah, at the level of the algebra, they are the same.
Also, at the level of group, I was going to ask whether the other covering part has any physical interpretation, but.
No, but in fact, all the theory is going to be written in terms of
algebra.
I think it's just that here, indeed, when we really see that geometrically, can be seen as a rotation. So usually the rotation is SO3, but then we are going to write everything in terms of SU2 object. Okay. But so here, what does it mean that we have? So what is this additional gate symmetry? This means that we can define a new. The new triad at each point by rotating J mu of x. Okay, so this is your additional gauge symmetry. So again, this can be done at any point of spacetime. And it does not change. The metric. So let's see if you see directly why. So let's write, let's use again the same formula, but in terms of the transform triad here. Okay? So I'm going to use the transform triad here, A mu k prime L. And let's see if this is again G mu nu. Okay? So let's write this in terms of the original triad. So we have RKI mu LJ. Can you tell me why this indeed simplifies into G mu nu, meaning that this equation here really simplifies into this equation? What are we using here? What is the property we are using on the rotation matrix? Yeah, Eugene, I know that you know, but maybe.
Yeah, the transpose is the inverse?
Yeah, so here you're just using that R transpose R is identity. Okay, so this is what I wanted to tell you about. The first ingredient we need to go to the first order formulation is this triad, okay? But now we are going to need an additional ingredient, in fact, which is what we call the spin connection. And why do we need that? So now I need to introduce the notion of, so it's a new connection. And indeed, so now we are going to have objects with internal indices, which are the ij, okay? Internal indices. And of course, we still have the spacetime.
One question?
Yeah.
Why is it called first order formulation?
It's called first order formulation because you won't have the you don't have the same order of derivative as the gym union, okay? So I'm going to show you, and then the equation of motion are going to be just linear. So, yeah. And in fact, we are going to see when we are going to go to the to talk about the Hamiltonian formulation of any for any system, that in fact any system can be transformed into a first order system. It's just when you instead of when you have an action, usually you consider that your action is just a function of the position, okay, q. But then when you go to the Hamiltonian formulation, okay, you have P and Q, but usually you say that just Q is a function of P. Okay? But so here the idea would be just to say for this action to consider that P and Q are independent variables. So you really work with Q as an independent variable. So now this means that when you look at your equation of motion, you won't have only the equation of motion with the Q variable, but also the P variable. So usually when you consider that your action is just a function of Q, then you have P and Q, which are conjugate variables. But now if you consider, you can always consider your action with P and Q as independent variable. And then if you look at the conjugate momentum, then you will have momenta, you will have associate momentum for P and one for Q, okay?
So here then, it's more because we will consider both the connection and the triad
as independent variables. Okay. So indeed, you're right. Here we are going to introduce the spin connection, and we are going to see that the spin connection can be expressed just in terms of the the triad. But then we are going to choose. So instead of having this. So the relation between the spin connection and the triad already implemented in the constraint in the action, we're going to consider these two variables are independent, and then the relation between the two variables are going to come as the equation of motion, in fact. Okay. Okay. So and we have so these are my any other question before I move. Okay. So these are my space-time internal indices, and I still have the. And so, of course, since now you have additional indices, we will have to need a transformation. Rule with respect to the internal indices. And so we'll see that that's why we need to introduce this spin connection. And of course, here they're going to transform as usually we have the space-time tensor that we know how to modify. Okay. So for space-time indices, we have the usual covariant derivative with respect to space-time indices. So do you know in terms of which connection the covariant derivative is written? So just I'll consider space-time indices. So you know that you have a covariant derivative. So which is, let's write it like this. You know, so in terms of which connection is that written? You know the connection? From GR, you should know.
You mean in a tangent bundle?
Yeah, it's in this covariant derivative. How do you define this covariant derivative? So it's a derivative, and then you will have.
Christoffel.
Yeah, so we have the Christoffel symbol, or as we call the Levi-Civita connection. Yeah, the Christoffel symbol. Indeed, if you call that symbol, maybe you haven't noticed it. So here it's with respect to which is the Levi-Civita connection. So it's a unique connection which is torsion-free and metric compatible, okay, with gym union. And why do we need this covariant derivative? We use that to parallel transform space-time tensor, okay? And also what is the property is that if V nu is a vector, then if you apply this covariant derivative to this vector, then you get the tensor, okay? So here, this is needed to parallel transport space-time tensor. And a really important property of that is if you start with a vector or a tensor, so if V mu is a vector, then this is going to be a tensor. Okay. So this is if you have only space-time indices, okay? But now we have these internal indices. So for this, we need a covariant derivative. I'm just going to, I won't have time to finish. I'm just going to give you the expression, and then we are going to see tomorrow what are the property of this. So here, what is, but here, be careful, what we have in addition, it's internal indices. And so we need a covariant derivative with respect to internal indices. And for that, we're going to introduce a spin connection, omega, with two internal indices and one space-time indices, so it's a spin and so why do we want this covariant derivative? We want to parallel transport object with internal indices as here, and also we want to ensure a proper transformation behavior under internal rotation, okay, of the covariant derivative. So exactly the same motivation. Yeah?
So please add a question. And in defining the Christoffel symbols, we use them because space-time can have some curvature and stuff, so you bring each power transport from one tangent space to another, for example. So in the case of these spin connections for the internal spaces, do we need them because of the possible non-trivial topology that the space-time we are dealing with might have, or is it?
This is not related to the topology here. Even with the trivial topology, if you want to parallel transport your from a tangent space to the other, you need to have this spin connection. Okay, so this is really it's not related to the complex to the topology of the manifold. So we have exactly the same motivation as here, but now with this covariant derivative. So and just to give you the expression, and we will come back on that tomorrow. So now we have this covariant derivative with respect to internal and space-time indices. I'm going to, so internal and space-time. Indices, so we are going to use this notation. So for example, if I want to just, I'm considering a vector in the internal space, then I'm going to define this covariant derivative using the spin connection. And now if I'm considering a one form, for the internal space, it's almost similar, but with a minus here. And of course, if I have an object with space-time indices and internal indices, then I need to combine J minus mu nu, let's call this rho, plus, so here it's like a vector, so it's this one I'm using, plus omega j mu k v, sorry, v k. Yeah.
Do we have a replacement for torsion-free and metric-compatible properties for the?
Yeah, and it's what we're going to see tomorrow. Yeah. Okay. So this is the last equation I'm going to give you today, and tomorrow I will start with this equation, and we want that. So what we are going to want here is that d mu is compatible with the Levi-Civita connection and the associate covariant derivative. And so we'll see what we need to require from this covariant derivative. So, well, connection and associate. And so we'll see tomorrow what are the conditions. Okay? So, any more questions? Okay, so thanks a lot.